So a few weeks back, I did the decline and fall of the Western Roman Empire in 20 minutes. And last week we did Augustine, the greatest figure in the history of the church between the Apostle Paul and the Reformation, in 30 minutes. So just because it seems like I'm taking forever on this, I am moving a little. So anyway, but I want to talk a little bit this morning about some of the legacy of the Western Roman Empire in the church. So next slide. And that's why I picked this passage out of Jeremiah 17, because one of the things that comes out of the fall of the Roman Empire in the West and the establishment of kingdoms, which are basically tribal German kingdoms, from tribal peoples that have come down out of Germany and Northern Europe and have overrun what is now Italy and France and Spain and across North Africa, is that the church is left as the one trusted and potentially powerful institution in that whole area. And so there is a legacy that comes down through the church, and particularly in the Roman Catholic Church, that is tied to Imperial Rome, in the Imperial Rome in the West. The church, the government, and the empire having fallen, takes on some of those elements and holds on to them and preserves some of them. And of course, it's interesting, you know, when you think of the Roman Catholic Church today, it's not just called Roman Catholic because the Pope lives in Rome. It's also called Roman Catholic because there is a Roman imprint on it. Both in the East and the West, as we move to the 6th century, there is an imperial mark on the church. In the East, it's because the bishop at Constantinople lives down the street from the emperor, and the emperor has a lot of opinions about how that bishop should do his job. And there is, for the next 10 centuries, eight to 10 centuries, conflict on a regular basis between the bishop, the archbishop at Constantinople, and the emperor at Constantinople. And so that church, the church in the East, becomes more and more influenced by the way that the emperor is running the empire and imperial elements of that. In the West, in Rome, the Bishop of Rome becomes the Pope and claims authority over all the church in the West, and the Bishop of Rome begins to take on the trappings of the emperor and begins to dress kind of like the emperor and do things that the emperor used to do in the city of Rome. And so the Bishop of Rome begins to lead processions and conduct ceremonial things in the city that the emperor used to do when there was an emperor in the West. And now that the emperor is gone, the bishop of Rome takes on these kinds of roles. So there we see an imperial church in both the East and the West. One of the challenges of the conversion of Constantine and all the things that came out of that is the degree to which the empire comes into the church and influences the way that the church thinks and the way that the church works. And in the West, there is some pursuit of the memory of the Roman Empire in the West as, you know, kind of the good times in the past, as a glorious past that we keep leaning back to and turning back to. And so there is this sense that the church at Rome between the beginning and the early 300s and the late 400s went through a period that is a kind of a glorious era, that the emperor having been converted to the faith and many, many senior people, members of the Senate, other key Roman figures having come into the church, that this was a kind of a glorious moment in the church. And when, you know, we saw last week when we were thinking about Augustine writing the City of God, he is confronting, part of what he's confronting is in the church this sense that the conversion of the emperor and through the emperor the conversion of the empire was the great moment in the history of the church, and that this would cause Jesus to return, that this would cause the end of all things, that this was the great moment that we had all been pointing towards. And as the empire starts to collapse, people in the church become very confused. This is not the way that I thought this was going to happen. This is not what I thought the outcome was going to be. And people in the church have become in many ways entangled with the empire and with the government and with an image that is, you know, of a truly Christian empire, which hasn't really existed in that time. You know, although there are emperors who are serious Christians down through this age, the empire is never truly Christian in any real way. And the church, because of the influx of all these Roman people and Roman practices, becomes influenced by a lot of Roman customs and choices, some of which are pagan things. And so as the empire starts to collapse in the West, Rome becomes basically indefensible. And so Rome is sacked a couple of times and barely averted being sacked by Attila the Hun on top of that. And so the emperor has moved to Milan originally and then to Ravenna on the east coast on the Adriatic Sea, Ravenna being defensible. In the sense that Ravenna has easy access to the sea to bring reinforcements in, and it's surrounded mostly by marshes, low country that is not suitable for the movement and stationing of an army. And so Ravenna is basically impossible to besiege because the territory outside the city walls is mostly uninhabitable and totally unsuitable for military forces and military operations. And so the last of the Roman emperors are all based at Ravenna. And when the final Roman emperor, a teenager, finds himself without any army at all to defend the city, he surrenders the city to the king of the Ostrogoths, and Italy, what we think of now as Italy, becomes an Ostrogothic kingdom for a century or so. But Ravenna becomes this new fountain of culture and art. Ravenna becomes a critical economic pivot in this era. Rome falls, the city of Rome falls into some decline, but Ravenna becomes a place where people spend a lot of money on art and cultural things. And the church starts to use architecture, art, and music, and the ceremonial aspects of what the church does to attract people in. The Ostrogoths are a tribal people from Germany that don't have a written language and are almost all illiterate. Most of the Ostrogothic kings of that century that they rule in what is now Italy are unlettered men who have no ability to read or write, and the Ostrogothic language that they use is never put into written form except by a few missionaries. It never becomes widely used as a written language. And so the conquerors find themselves dependent on people that are still there that have the remnants of Roman education and a Roman background, because those people know how to actually run a city. Those people know how to collect taxes on some regular basis, how to get organized and keep records and that sort of thing. The Ostrogothic kings in Italy become very dependent on a lot of ethnic Roman people, people that are trained in the Roman citizen, as in the Roman heritage and the Roman educational system, but find that they really can't quite trust them, because these are smart people and they know languages I don't know, and they can communicate in ways that I can't see. They write letters to people far away. I don't know what they're talking about and what they're doing. And so one of the problems with the Ostrogothic kingdom is the king would become suspicious of some guy who was his functional prime minister or whatever, not be able to know for sure whether this guy was writing to his enemies or doing other things that he disapproved of. And so he would have this guy executed just on point of principle that he might be conspiring against him, which made it harder, of course, over the long term to retain employees. But the church is trying to attract people in, these tribal peoples who have little background and no literacy, by building great buildings and creating works of art and creating music that attracts unbelievers into the church. And by communicating the idea that the leaders of the church are very important people that are worthy of listening to, which is why bishops start dressing in a way that makes them look like they're sort of friends of the emperor. But this is partly evangelistic in intent. We also see kind of the imperial attitude towards authority. All the bishops in the West become political figures. They become dependent upon to lead in the city, to make things go, to answer questions, to arbitrate disputes. So they functionally become basically secular princes. And some of them are very cautious and careful about this, rendering judgment and acting as judges and doing other things, and trying to do this in a mindset that is very much driven by the church. But some of them find that it's pretty cool to become sort of the local prince. And the church, having acquired in the last couple of centuries of the Western Roman Empire a great deal of property. This, of course, because there were so many people that didn't have heirs, and so they left their farms and villas and other resources to the church. The bishops find themselves with significant income because they own significant property. And this produces food and wine and all manner of other products which are sold, and it becomes a constant income to the church, which is one of the things that fuels the building of cathedrals and the acquisition of art, and puts bishops in a position where they can dress really well and where they can do other things, ceremonial sorts of things that catch the attention of others. There's also a distancing here. There still is an emperor, except for the emperor is in Constantinople. And the emperor still speaks Greek and writes letters in Greek. But the West has become the Latin zone, and people speak and read Latin. And so there's now a language barrier between the people of the West and the emperor in the East. The emperor no longer has political or military control in the West, and now the emperor is speaking a different language from the people in the West. And the bishops in the West have all become Latin-speaking. And so they see not only the emperor, but also the bishop at Constantinople as being less relevant because they speak that other language that we used to speak and we don't do that anymore. There's also the problem here that Roman education was based on the idea that you found a teacher and you paid them. People made fairly good money if they were good teachers because they attracted students. Augustine spent 15 or so years before his conversion to the faith as a teacher. And as a teacher, he had to attract and recruit his own students. And in general, students didn't pay until the end of the term. So if at the end of the term they didn't like your class, they generally didn't pay you hardly anything. And so people that weren't very good teachers didn't make any money doing that and were pushed out of the business. People that were really good teachers attracted a lot of students and made quite a bit of money. But as a result, this was a really informal system. And when the government fell and the Goths came in, it was harder to find students and there were fewer and fewer teachers. It became more and more difficult to become an educated person. And this caused the level of literacy across the West to fall significantly. Most of the tribal peoples that came in were largely or entirely illiterate. And this caused the church to become one of the few places where there was still training in reading and writing and literature and actually studying books and learning things. And this created a situation where most of the learned people, by the time you get to the 7th century, are people in the church, which creates kind of a functional aristocracy, which is people in the church that can read and write and have a background, a good education, and then the rest of everybody who do not. And so people depend on leaders in the church in these ways, but this also creates kind of an aristocratic sense that key leaders in the church stand above everybody else. They have access to information that others don't have. We also see the bishops starting to, there's been for centuries people have been talking about the throne of the bishop, that there is a chair in the cathedral or in the key place in the city where the Christians meet that is a chair for the bishop to sit down. And this is still an era where almost everybody stands during the worship, where there are no, the pew has not yet been invented. Okay, so there are not many chairs or pews in churches. The churches are open space and people come in and stand and kind of group together as families or with the people that they know. But there's a chair up front for the bishop to sit in. The bishop is honored and often older, and so there's a chair. And so people early on started calling it the bishop's throne, not in an ironic way, but in the sense that we honor the bishop by providing him a chair. But by the 6th century, the bishop's throne in many cathedrals starts to look throne-like. They start spending a lot of extra money on it. And so the bishop starts dressing the part to sit on his throne and in many cases starts to take on the attitude of someone who dresses like a king and sits on a throne when they're in public. So we start to see beyond the 5th century, it's really at the fall of the Western Roman Empire that we start to see public art that is funded by the church and that is identifiably Christian. Before that, most of the art that we see from earlier eras is the sort of thing that you see in catacombs and burial art kinds of things. But now, if you're an artist who has money, pretty much only the church and a few people that are successful merchants. And so artists begin working primarily for the church. And so we see a significant growth of art in and for the church. And we've seen over the last couple of centuries butting heads between bishops and political leaders, where bishops claim great authority in the spiritual realm. And this leads by the 7th century to significant claims on the part of bishops to authority over political leaders. But we also see more of kind of a turn towards an authoritarian kind of a concept of the church. There's a lot more telling than teaching going on, and a lot more focus on, I'm sort of the one who's in charge here, so let me tell you about stuff. So this model of teaching here, with the bishop standing on an elevated platform and everybody else listening, the bishop here sitting on a more throne-like kind of a chair here in the front of the church and wearing very nice vestments and wearing kind of a crown sort of a thing becomes much more common in this era. And so there is more telling than teaching and more liturgy than preaching, and the bishops assume a lot more authority, and we see the fading of the authority and influence of presbyters and elders pretty much across the church. The previous first century model of the church, where there is elders working together and serving together and holding one another accountable in various places, is faded away almost entirely by the 7th century. The church also gained some sense from the Roman Empire of, conquest is a great way to broaden what you're doing. The Roman Empire had been very successful for centuries at conquering peoples and then absorbing them into the empire, getting them to think in Roman ways and align to what the empire was doing. The Roman Empire had for centuries been very effective at this. It is the giant numbers of people in these Germanic tribes that start coming across the borders in the 4th century that eventually break that down and prevent the empire from continuing to absorb people groups like that. But until then, the Roman Empire had been very successful at expanding by absorbing groups of people in and getting them to believe what Romans believed in it and act in ways that Romans wanted to act. So when you look, when you think about the Roman Empire in the first century, when the church is being founded, the time of Jesus, the apostles, the actual number of Roman troops that are on occupation duty in any part of the empire is relatively few, a few thousand in most places. Judea was famously fractious and rebellious and required more troops than most places, and there probably were not 10,000 Roman troops in all of Judea. And so the Romans had figured out a way to occupy large territories and not have to put a giant military force there to keep the lid on. And so this idea kind of comes into the church. And the church begins to see this idea of kind of conquering and converting huge groups of people. So this is Clovis, king of the Franks. The Franks are a Germanic tribe that invades and conquers what is now northern France. Clovis, as the king of the Franks, is influenced by the conquered people of Burgundy to marry a local gal that is presented to him as a Burgundian princess, Clotilde. And Clotilde is a Christian. And so, like Solomon, Clovis marries a woman of another faith. And like Solomon, he eventually gets pulled into her faith. And Clovis becomes a Christian because he married a Christian. And when Clovis becomes a Christian, he announces to the Frankish people that they are all now Christians too. And thus, the Frankish kingdom becomes converted to Christ en masse in AD 496. All of them. At once. Hundreds of thousands of people are converted to the faith at one moment. And so, who teaches them? Who catechizes them? Who brings them into the faith? And so the church adopts, this one actually kind of works. The conversion of the Frankish people is actually in many ways a significant success story from the perspective of the institutional church, at least. And so it becomes, to some extent, a model. We convert the king, we get the whole deal. And here's the thing about Clovis, our man Clovis, his successors as the king of the Franks are almost without exception for the next three centuries loyal to the church at Rome. Not just loyal in an abstract sense, loyal in a I will send an army to protect you sense. And so for the next three, four, five centuries, the Frankish king leads armies into Italy to defend the Pope every few decades. In the late 700s, Carl, king of the Franks, leads an army because he gets a letter from the Pope that says, I'm in serious danger and I need your help. Carl takes an army to Rome to defend the Pope. And before he leaves on Christmas Day of 800, the Pope crowns him emperor as a thank you. And we know Carl as Charlemagne. And the thing that he founded as the new emperor, we call the Holy Roman Empire. Which, of course, the long-standing joke is that the Holy Roman Empire was neither holy nor Roman nor an empire. But in any case, that was set in motion by the conversion of Clovis by his wife Clotilde in AD 496, which led to the conversion of the entire Frankish people and set in motion events that would influence the history of Europe for more than a millennium. So these are all things that are going on, the legacy of the Roman Church, the Roman Empire in the Roman Church and in the Church in the West, and to some extent for us. Next slide. We also see, these guys are major leaders of the Church. From the ancient era here, this guy up here in the top left is the Catholicos, Nursus I the Great of Armenia. He died in 373, but he was the head of the Armenian church, the Catholicos, from which we get the word Catholic, which is universal. So if you are the Catholicos, you are the universal head of the church. This guy down here is the metropolitan of Kiev in all Rus, Maximos. Maximos didn't die till 1305, so it's almost a millennia later, even though the picture looks earlier. But he is the metropolitan. Metropolitan is a leader of the church that is in a metropolis that has authority over other churches. And he is the metropolitan based in Kiev, who claims authority of the church over the church in all of Russia. This guy in the middle, of course, we talked about here a couple of weeks. This is Leo the First, Pope Leo the Great, the Bishop of Rome from 440 to 461, and the first guy to really be the Pope at Rome. This guy over here on the right is Eutychus. He was Patriarch of Constantinople in the middle of the 6th century for most of 30 years. So, what's the difference between a Catholicos and a Metropolitan and a Pope and a Patriarch? Which are all important titles for senior leaders in the church. So, a Catholicos is a traditional title which is used almost exclusively in the Eastern Church. The chief bishop of the church at Armenia has been called the Catholicos since the 4th century. And the Church of Armenia has an uninterrupted list of who's been the Catholicos since the 4th century down to today. And you can, you know, pull up on the internet the guy who is currently the Catholicos of Armenia. The bishop at Ctesiphon, which was a major city in what is now Iraq, a Mesopotamian city which became a huge center of the church from the 5th century for another four centuries beyond that. The bishop there eventually claimed to be superior to all the other bishops in the Eastern Church. And this happened in the early 300s. And so Papa Bar Gagai was the... that's probably not correctly pronounced, was the bishop of the church there and claimed to become the Catholicos of the church in the East. And eventually, the title of that bishop became the Bishop of Seleucia Ctesiphon, the Catholicos and head over all the bishops of all the Orient. Which was an assertion over the entire Eastern Church. So the term Catholicos lives on in the Eastern Church, not just in Armenia, but in other places, as an assertion of this is the bishop who has authority over the whole church. A metropolitan is common, you know, in the church, the kind of Greek, Russian, Serbian, that sort of Slavic church is a common title. Basically, the metropolitan is a metropolitan bishop, a bishop of a metropolis, that is a chief city of a Roman province originally. If you were the bishop of the city, there was the big city in the Roman province, those bishops became known as the metropolitan bishops early on. And so a metropolitan had authority over other bishops, or claimed authority over other bishops, because the metropolitan was in a bigger, more important city. A city where there was a governor or a king or something like that. And so that gave that bishop a claim to have oversight over the other bishops who also lived under that governor or that king. And so you can't be a metropolitan unless you have subordinate bishops, which are in the modern era called suffragan bishops, because they live by your sufferance. They are dependent on the larger bishop. But the first metropolitan bishops were actually appointed at the Council of Nicaea in AD 325. One of the things that council did was affirm that certain bishops were metropolitan bishops and therefore had authority over other bishops. And so in the Eastern Orthodox Church today, you have metropolitans. There's a metropolitan of Moscow and a metropolitan of Kiev. The Ukrainian Church has metropolitans. The Russian Orthodox Church has metropolitans. And so this terminology is common there. The term patriarch, of course, goes all the way back to the beginning in the Old Testament. Father, a formal term for father. Originally, the bishops of Alexandria and Antioch and Jerusalem were known as patriarchs. By the beginning of the second century, that became a common term, that these were key church fathers. And we talk about the patristic era, the era of the church fathers. That's partly because of this idea that certain bishops were patriarchs. The Bishop of Armenia claimed to be a patriarch very early on. By the 6th century, there are more than 100 bishops in the Eastern Church that carry the title patriarch. And so this title had become very widely used, which is why you needed a Catholicos over all these patriarchs, I guess. But patriarchs are bishops that claim authority through a region or through a particularly ethnic church, or all the people who speak this language, or all the people of this tribe or tongue or nation. I'm the bishop of all these people. That makes me the patriarch. The Pope, Pope Papa, a father, the daddy, a term that, of course, is first used by the bishop at Alexandria more than two centuries before it becomes associated by the bishop of Rome, more famously. But the bishop of Alexandria today is still called the Pope. It's just that there are several of them because there's been splits in the church and there are issues about who's in charge. The Bishop of Rome by the 5th century is known as the Pope. And the Pope is a bishop that basically claims authority over all the bishops everywhere. So both the Pope at Alexandria and the Pope at Rome both claim to be the ultimate authority in the church everywhere, that everybody in the church falls under them. And you also eventually get some other titles. Archbishop, of course, becomes a title for a bishop that has some regional authority, or a bishop of an important city that has a cathedral. If there's actually a cathedral, a large building in that city, then the bishop becomes an archbishop. An archbishop doesn't necessarily have subordinate bishops. That's a term that is still widely used today, and particularly in the Western Church. And eventually, the Roman Catholic Church in particular pioneers the use of the term cardinal, a prince of the church, which is basically somebody that has voting rights and elections for the Pope. So that's generally a senior bishop, but doesn't have to be somebody who has a seat, a place that they minister. In the Roman Catholic Church, a number of cardinals have administrative jobs in the Vatican and are on other kinds of assignments where they do not have a regional pastoral responsibility. But it's important to see that all these terms for senior leaders in the church come from fairly early on, and they're all attempts to set some kind of rank and create some hierarchy among the bishops, primarily as a way to try to figure out how do we resolve disputes between bishops, and how do we create some kind of path of appeal when we can't agree about things in the church. But as a result, we have a wide variety of different terms that come out of this era that still stick with us today. And so there are still those that carry not only the label Pope, but Patriarch or Catholicos or Metropolitan. All these are current names for senior leaders in the church. So next slide. We've seen up through into the 6th century, we've seen the expansion of the church. But by the time you get to 500 AD, The church is also having to deal with the fact that there are some places where the church is not expanding, where the church is actually contracting. So all these cities, by the way, are places that there were significant meetings of bishops at one time or another. Nicaea 325 and Constantinople, the first of these in 381, these various meetings that bishops got together to try to confront major issues in the church primarily across the Western church. Other than Nicaea in Antioch a couple of times, most of these meetings did not draw very many bishops from the East. And so this is the Western church. This is a map that's deficient because it doesn't show us the church beyond Armenia and Georgia, across into across the Sassanid Persian Empire and down into India, in a way into Central Asia, in the church in Ethiopia, and extending down into the east coast of Africa. Those are things that, this tends to be a Roman perspective when people make the maps. And so significant parts of the church don't show up on the map. But this is the church in the West. And a couple of things are important to realize, that the church evangelized Britannia early. I mean, maybe as soon as Simon the Zealot in the first century, but by the second century, the Celtic peoples of what is now England, of Britannia, have been evangelized. And there is a church there, and there are bishops that attend many of these early meetings and councils. A bishop came from Britannia to Nicaea in AD 325, in several of these follow-up ones. But in the fifth century, Britannia, the Roman province, falls to invasions by people from this area up here, the Angles and the Saxons. And the Angles and the Saxons, invading what is now England, wipe out the Celtic peoples there, push some of them across into what is now Ireland or north into Scotland, but the rest of them mostly are killed off. So that the population in the early 6th century here is all Angles and Saxons, and none of them are believers. And the church in Britannia has vanished. And the Pope at Rome takes initiative to send missionaries to this Anglo-Saxon kingdom where there used to be a church, and which now must be evangelized again. There are all these areas in here when the Roman Empire has great influence on them. Those are Christian areas. And when the empire begins to collapse, these are areas where there are essentially no Christians left at all. The Visigoths and Ostrogoths come out of the east, pushed primarily by the Huns, settle in these areas, and there is some evangelization there. As the Huns begin to press west, the Visigoths and the Ostrogoths find that they can't conquer Constantinople, and so they begin to move west. They conquer Milan, Rome, they move out. The Visigoths end up out here. The Ostrogoths make a kingdom here. But those people mostly need to be converted, and the people that come behind them to occupy this area are entirely unevangelized. And the Vandals coming out of here come down through here, conquer all this part of North Africa, and those are unevangelized people. And so we have the church finally begins to see that it expands and sometimes it contracts. And people in the church are starting to have to deal with, what does that mean? Doesn't the gospel always continue to go forth? How can there be a church and then not be a church? And this will become a very big issue in the centuries to come as the church in many places begins to collapse. But the church has begun to create impact well beyond what used to be the Roman Empire. And so by 500, of course, the Roman Empire is really this area here, based around Constantinople. Because the rest of this has all been, actually some of this down here, Alexandria is still part of the empire. But the rest of all this has been conquered by all these barbarian kingdoms, so they said. And so the church finds that it's about people and not about places, or at least begins to start to think about this. But this becomes hard for people in the church to realize that that the church grows in some places and doesn't in others. One of the other things that's going on here, next slide, is the question of the Jewish church. This is from the Roman theater at Miletus, which of course is referred to several times in the New Testament. Paul visits Miletus as part of his missionary work. We don't know very much about that, but this is at the end of one of the sections in the Roman theater in Miletus. It was put in somewhere between the 2nd and 5th century. It's a reserved section sign. And it says, the place of the Jews and the God-fearers. Between the 2nd and 6th century, in the public theater at Miletus, there was a reserved section for Jews and the God-fearers who attended the synagogue with them as a separate group so they could sit separate from everybody else. And there were reserved sections. There are a number of reserved sections. The reserved section signs are preserved in Miletus in a number of places in the theater. But this is, Jews were culturally acceptable in many, many places across the Western Roman Empire, even though they were regarded as really different. Romans regarded Jews as atheists. That is, if you don't believe in the pantheon, if you don't believe in a polytheistic worldview, you're not believers in, since you're not believers in the gods, you are therefore atheists. Monotheism was a really foreign concept, and so Christians were often accused of atheism in the Roman period. But Jews were a significant part of the New Testament church. Jews were 10 or 15% of the population of the empire. And Paul's focus is, in many cases, on ministry to the Jews. He almost always starts in the synagogue. Even at Philippi, where there's no synagogue, he goes to the place where Jewish people would normally meet to pray and starts there. And so he begins with the Jews as his target, even though he has been called to the Gentiles and eventually goes to do that. He always feels compelled to start with the Jews. And of the 12 apostles, how many of them are Jews? All of them. All 12. Okay? So there's huge Jewish leadership in the early church and a very large presence of Jewish people in the church in the first and second century. Now, you know, Jews have a long and troubled relationship with Rome. So when they are socially accepted, this is sort of different. Jews were expelled from Rome way back in 139 BC because of their tendency, quote, to infect Roman morals, unquote. They were regarded as a bad influence, that they got people away from pagan worship and pagan practices. They were opposed to abortion, and so this made them undesirable neighbors. And so they were expelled in 139 BC. Tiberius expelled Jews from Rome in AD 19. Claudius expelled Jews from Rome in AD 49 for rioting over somebody Suetonius says over somebody named Crestus, who is a big factor, a big controversy point in the Jewish community at Rome in AD 49. This led to the expulsion of Aquila and Priscilla from Rome at that point. In Domitian in AD 95, executed a large number of people because, quote, they drifted into Jewish ways, unquote. Mostly these were God-fearers, that is, people who did not get circumcised and become part of the Jewish community, but who attended the synagogue and read the scripture and engaged in the prayers. Domitian did that despite one of the people that he had executed was a prominent cousin of his. Jews, of course, are greatly impacted by the destruction of the Jerusalem temple in AD 70, which led to the death of many key Jewish leaders, and the Jerusalem church relocating to Pella on the east side of the Jordan. And that left Jews worshiping only in the synagogue and without the sacrificial worship at the temple and without being able to focus back on the temple as the key point. The Emperor Vespasian then imposed a special tax on Jews. Jews had paid a temple tax for centuries. And, you know, Jesus, he pays the temple tax, right? And the Roman Emperor says, hey, there's no temple anymore. You can pay the tax to me. In fact, because I'm better than whatever was in the temple, you can pay double the temple tax to me. And so Jews now carry a special tax in the Roman world after AD 70. And this, you know, is a big loss of influence for the Jerusalem church because it's now kind of in exile. In AD 135, Bar Kokhba claims to be the Messiah, leads a revolt that leads to the destruction of the city of Jerusalem and Jews being banned from coming within sight of the city of Jerusalem. The city is repopulated as Aelia Capitolina, an entirely Gentile city with a Roman name. And so Jews are scattered. The Jewish Christians in Judea seem to have en masse refused to join that revolt, partly because Bar Kokhba called himself the Messiah. And this leads to a significant split between Jews and Jewish Christians. And so Jews become stigmatized as rebels and troublemakers and feel assaulted on many sides and have problems preserving their ancient traditions. And so all this reduces the conversions to Christianity. However, you know, so the typical story is that the Jewish church goes away by the third century or something. But Jewish and Christian graves are close together wherever we can find real evidence of graves, either close together or intermingled all the way through the fourth century. In Rome, the catacombs where Jews are buried and the catacombs where Christians are buried are adjacent to one another in most cases. They're very close together. Churches are often directly across the street from the synagogue in many cities for the next several centuries. In Capernaum, the church and the synagogue are directly across the street from each other until the 7th century. There's no evidence that there was trouble. In Galilee, through the 6th century, you can see marks on buildings and on tombs that combine Jewish and Christian imagery, a menorah with a cross or a fish kinds of things, all the way through the 6th century. This is, people identify with both of these things. At Nicaea in AD 325, 8 cities in Judea send a bishop. So there is still a major Jewish or major presence in Jewish areas of the church. Even after the fall of the Western Roman Empire, it's pretty common for rabbis to be consulted about the interpretation of the Old Testament. In AD 388, after the Roman Emperor has claimed Christianity as the official religion of the Roman Empire, in 388, the Romans pass a law prohibiting the intermarriage of Christians and Jews. Now, you don't outlaw stuff that's not happening. You only outlaw stuff that is happening that you think is not so good for one reason or another. So clearly there was a lot of interaction between Christians and Jews. John Chrysostom, preaching in Constantinople at the end of the 4th century, complains that Christians are still attending synagogue all the time. And that it makes the case that you cannot be in full fellowship in the synagogue and in full fellowship in the church. That if you're going to be in full fellowship in the church, you have to fully commit to that. You can't keep also being engaged in the Jewish worship at the same time. But it's likely that the Jewish mission continued up at least through the 6th or 7th century, that there were still Jews coming into the church and many Christians who were ethnically Jews and felt significant connections to Judaism. Keep in mind that, you know, in the first century in the New Testament era, we see a lot of Hellenized Jews, a lot of Jews that have taken on Greek culture and don't continue to practice key parts of Jewish life. And many of these people are people that no longer think of themselves as ethnically Jews. They just think of themselves as religiously Jews, and Christianity is a pretty good cultural fit for them because you don't have to be part of an ethnic group to join the church. And the gospel message, incorporating things in the Old Testament and honoring the Old Testament as scripture, provided a way for people who were raised as Jews to maintain a connection with the fundamentals of the faith while not doing some of the ethnic kinds of things that maybe they thought, I don't care about that, or that doesn't fit for me, or something like that. And it seems like Jews and Christians had relational networks that were very overlapping. The church was nearby. They buried their people in the same places. They lived around each other. It is through these kinds of relational networks that people are converted. So it is likely that the Jewish church fades over time, but it doesn't really go away until probably the 8th or 9th, maybe even the 10th century, that there is still a significant number of Jews in the church and a significant number of Jews who are being converted. It's only by about the 10th century that the church tends to start thinking about Jews as sort of the enemy, and you start to see an underlying anti-Semitism in a lot of things that people in the church are doing. But that comes later on. And one more thing that I just thought was interesting. Next slide. This idea of praying at various times of the day, we see it in various ways, particularly in the New Testament. People go out at the hour of prayer to do something. And so in the patristic era, people start practicing a cycle of prayer across the day where people pray at particular times because they think the times, those times of the day, are important. The Didache back in the 2nd century told people you need to pray the Lord's Prayer three times every day. Psalm 119, 164 says, seven times a day I praise you for your righteous laws. Now, the writer of that is probably using seven in a figurative sense, meaning perfection, completion all through the day. You know, how many times shall I forgive? 7 times 7 times 70. These 7 is being used here as a number that indicates perfection or fulfillment. But a lot of people looked at Psalm 119 and said 7 times a day and thought, I got to find 7 slots during the day when I sit down and pray. This is what I should be doing. Hippolytus, in running the apostolic traditions in the second century, recommends that people pray 7 times a day. And so these ideas became more and more common, and particularly monastic communities found ways to create a list of 7 times or a list of times during the day when you should get together and pray. And so these became the canonical hours, and various lists have been used, but this is kind of just a roll-up of the canonical hours that are practiced even today, particularly in monastic communities, but among some others in the church. And some don't practice all of these, but some practice more than a few. Some of these are, I pick 3 of these or something like that, but these remain fairly common. And they go back all the way to the 3rd century or so, most of these. But these are the idea of you divide the day into fixed times of prayer, regular in intervals. By the medieval era, we see people with breviaries or a book of the hours. And these are the hours that the book is about. These are prayer guides that are tied to times and during the day. And so in the Roman Catholic Church, these are called not the canonical hours, but the offices. They're the official set of prayers. There's an official prayer that goes with each one of these or a set of them. The divine service, the divine duty. And some call this the work of God, in Latin, opus Dei. Which is an important term in the Roman Catholic Church about commitment. And of course, there's a Roman Catholic organization that goes by that name, that is people that are highly committed to the faith. But others call this, the divine office or that sort of stuff. These are known, this is kind of to separate them out from communion and baptism and other things that that you do on a weekly or less often basis. But in the churches in the East, this kind of a list is very common. And the lists, although they're different, are not that different. They're a whole lot the same. So these terms are mostly Latin and come out of the Roman church, but the same practice goes on a lot of the time. So vigil, representing the night watches. This is associated with Christ's prayer at Gethsemane. And the people that practice this often are thinking about that and often driven by that. Matins is awaiting the dawn, awaiting the coming of Christ, awaiting the risen Lord. Matins is prayers of anticipation that dawn is coming, that good is coming, that he will return. Lauds is a time of praise and thanksgiving, the coming of the day, the rising of the Lord, he is risen indeed. Prime is in honor of Jesus' practice to go out early in the morning to pray, to begin the day in prayer. Terce marks the coming of the Holy Spirit in Acts chapter 2. At about the 3rd hour, this happens. It also marks the time of Christ's crucifixion. And so people pray at that time in remembrance of these things. The 6th hour, noon. Peter prayed in Acts 10 at noon. And the gospel went to the Gentiles. About noon, about the 6th hour, darkness covered the land when Christ was on the cross. And so some pray at noon, remembering darkness covering the land and thinking that at noon the greatest illumination of the sun is upon us and it is a time of greatest illumination and we should rejoice in the illumination that we have in Jesus and his life. Nuns is the time that Peter and John went up to pray at the temple in Acts chapter 3. The hour of prayer. It's also the time of the death of Christ on the cross. And people pray to remember that. Vespers, the closing of the day. Evensong is a term that is widely used. But a gathering to close out the day. And come clean is setting the night watch. Now, these are very formalized times in prayer. You know, we adhere to the call to pray without ceasing. You know, we gather at various times during the week. Our times don't align up with these very much, although our Wednesday evening prayer team meeting is basically Vespers. Kind of. Except it's informal. And we don't pray to a format. But this thinking about praying through the day, praying at various times, and the times themselves, the hours of the day having significance in the church and in our prayers, is something that has influenced the church for most of two millennia, and something that continues to influence people across the church. So as we think and pray, you know, it's important to realize and remember that we pray not just to remember the things that God has done in my life, in our lives, in my experience, in the last week or today, but that we should remember things that go much further back and the great and glorious things that he has done down through the ages. And so as we think about the history of the church and the ways that people have walked before us, they are influenced by these many things and these many perspectives, but the call to prayer at various times. You know, this, of course, is a significant influence on Islam. When Muhammad was writing up the Quran, he wanted to be like the Christians and the Jews. And one of the things that he was aware of was that Christians prayed at various times of the day. And so he included that in Islam, you know, as directed times of prayer through the course of the day. That's not an original thought, that he got that from the church. So anyway. Thank you for your time this morning. Lord, we thank you for your great love for us, and we thank you for the call that we should follow you, that we should not follow the princes of this world, and we should not fall prey to the things of these days. We pray that we would persist in following the things of your word, even as we seek to navigate the challenges of these times. And Lord, we thank you for the faithful who have persisted in these things in the midst of so many difficulties and distractions down through the ages. Pray that we would be faithful as well as we go forth to serve you in these days. Amen.